From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made through a camera lens where a mother, a father, and a sister are recording home movies. The clips show family dinners, holidays, and the everyday moments of this family's life. The movies also capture the journey of a young man named Brian, who has autism. In the film, The Limits of My World, filmmaker Heather Cassano shares what life is like for her brother, Brian, as he transitions from high school into adulthood. Now, Brian is nonverbal, and like many young adults with autism, receives help from a network of family, friends, and professional caregivers. The Limits of My World is a film that is raw and powerful, an honest look at the daily struggles people with autism and their families face. You'll have a chance to see it at the Little Theater this coming Monday, but this hour, we'll get a preview with the filmmaker. We'll discuss the challenges young adults with autism face and how parents, caregivers, and community members can help and can understand better. I'd like to welcome our guests. First of all, on the line with us is Heather Cassano, director of The Limits of My World. Good to have you. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the film, Heather.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Also with us in studio, Dr. Stephen Salkis is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Salkis, welcome back to the program.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is Melissa Parrish, a Golisano Autism Center family navigator at the Boys and Girls Club of Rochester and the parent of a teenager with autism. Melissa, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And also with us is Sarah Milko, executive director of Autism Up and a parent of a teenager with autism. Sarah, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's just make sure our audience knows it's 6 p.m. this coming Monday, so set your calendars for the Little Theater Monday, 6 p.m. for the film, about an hour long, and then there will be a Q&A with Heather via Skype following the screening. Tickets at the box office at The Little, of course, or online at thelittle.org. And Heather, I want to ask you, you know, when you think about the landscape of personal films, documentary-style films about autism, about families with autism, you know, there's a number of films that help tell these kinds of stories, and it's always instructive to find out from the filmmaker, why did you want to make this film? And then sort of for me, kind of the duality of what was it for you, and what is it for sort of the viewing public?
Sure. So my main goal with making this film was to diversify representations of autism in the media. We see a lot of films, documentaries, and narratives included about autism where people can speak, where they can do some tasks, where they're sort of functioning in society. Unfortunately, my brother can't do any of that. And I wanted to really give the audience a look at what it means to be nonverbal in today's society and what that means for my family.
And I also, you know, clearly take from the film, as we said in the introduction, the raw and sort of powerful presentation that, you know, you're not trying to kind of sugarcoat, I think it's fair to say, that there are very hard moments and there are very hard questions about relationships and what connection truly means. Take us through some of your perspective on that.
Yeah, sure. I tried my best when I was making the film to not project my own feelings on Brian. And I think that's kind of what we see with the rawness of the film. It's so easy for us to think that we know what's going on in someone's head. Like if Brian smiles, that he's happy, or if he's laughing at something that he thinks it's funny. But really, there's like no way that I can know that. And that was something that I really wanted to get across with the film, that everything I do for Brian is just a guess. And so when I'm using this like raw observational style footage in the film, that's what I'm trying to reflect, is I'm trying to present Brian as what I see in front of my camera to the audience and let them make their own conclusions about him and about his life.
Well, you tell us in the film that, you know, growing up, you and your brother were obviously doing different things and had very different lives and different kinds of lives. And you didn't have much of sort of a substantial relationship. The film helped you try to reconnect with Brian, but there are moments where in the film you feel like he sees you. It's just, just you and him. But as you just mentioned here, you wonder, am I really connecting or is this my feeling? And how? And I wonder from your perspective how you sort of emotionally deal with that, because you may never know exactly what kind of emotional response or resonance is actually happening with your brother.
Yeah, for sure. And it's really difficult, especially as a sibling. I'm sure others in the program who have autistic family members feel the same way. I just try my best to take everything that's in front of me, like at face value, and see like, what am I seeing here? How is my interaction with Brian going? And then, you know, make my feelings about him and about our relationship around that. And I do think the film has served as a vehicle for me to get closer to Brian. I spent over 200 hours filming him. And so just sitting with him and like looking at him through my camera really improved the way that I understood Brian.
I appreciate your honesty, not just as a filmmaker, but as a sister of someone who is nonverbal with autism. And it may be a guess to try to understand what he might be feeling at certain moments, but after so much time, what do you now feel like you understand better about him that you did not before?
Yeah, I feel like I understand his personality better. And I know that's kind of like a vague answer, but if you see the film on Monday, you'll see a little bit of that. I understand like that he is, you know, loving and caring, whereas before I thought he was more aggressive and angry. And now I realize that that is a symptom of the autism, and that when you really get down into it, he's a really sweet guy.
When you talk about how you think you used to think he was more aggressive, that's probably at least partially because sometimes for someone like Brian, emotion can manifest or feeling can manifest in a moment of taking a swing, a violent moment, or what appears to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that emotionally, especially when you've been hit? And, this is a family member, this is a sibling, this is someone you love, but you can't communicate verbally. You don't always feel like you can understand emotionally what you're dealing with. And then you're dealing with that, trying to, just be safe and navigate that. And I wonder if you felt like that is a difficult hurdle, not just for you, but for families with sort of similar situations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably one of the most mm-hmm. difficult things that anyone can go through. For me, I just try, at least now, when I was a teenager, this was very different and I had different feelings about this. But now I'm trying to put myself in Brian's shoes, like to think, what would it be like if I could think and I could understand the world, but I couldn't speak and I couldn't communicate with anyone. I would probably act out the same way, to be honest with you. And by putting myself in that perspective, I think I've been able to better deal with it and to not really fault Brian himself for this, but more his disability.
And Heather, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you a question about how you feel about the way systems work with people like your brother Brian, because we've had conversations on this program about whether it's a group home, school systems, family approach, the physicality that sometimes we see people use and systems use to work with and deal with people like your brother Brian, it can be very rough at times. How do you feel?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? And do you think, generally speaking, are systems taking care of Brian's needs, people like Brian? Are you worried that it can be too violent or too physically responsive?
Yeah, that's a tough question. So the school that Brian graduates from in the film was a school that took a more hands-on approach. And that was something that Brian himself needed. However, I'm not saying that that's what everyone needs. Mm-hmm. I think that the care that you give someone with autism needs to be very individualized. Brian is incredibly smart, and he was acting out because he knew that no one could control him. And then once it was clear that somebody could, he stopped, like cold turkey stopped. In less than a week being at Adverse, he stopped being violent. But that's not the case for everybody. And I think that individualization is really the key here, that accessibility and inclusion needs to be super individualized to everyone, not just blanket applied across a diagnosis.
The film is called The Limits of My World, and the director, Heather Cassano, is on the line with us for the first half hour of this hour. And you can see her film on Monday at the Little Theater, 6 p.m., get tickets at thelittle.org or at the Little box office. The film's about an hour long, and then a Q&A via Skype with the filmmaker. And The Little, so wonderful at bringing in these documentaries, these perspectives, and then giving you as an audience a chance to talk directly to the filmmaker. I want to turn it over to our guests in studio for them to have an opportunity to talk to Heather, because I actually walked in on them having a really intelligent conversation before the hour began. probably much more interesting than I could offer from the host chair. So I'm going to go around the table, and I'll start with Melissa Parrish. And what would you want to communicate with Heather?
Well, the first thing I like to say is thank you, Heather, for making a film that where your goal was to diversify representation. I think that's important. My son is 19 years old, not completely nonverbal, but very, very nonverbal. Mm-hmm. And so as I've been a part of different groups, as he's been in school, as I've learned about autism, I haven't always found him in those places. So thank you for at least recognizing that there is another story to be told and another perspective. So thanks for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Melissa, did anything stand out in the film to you that either you kind of keyed in on from your professional perspective that you thought, I can relate to this, this is not how I would do it, this frustrate, anything frustrate you?
One of the things that definitely struck me was the number of different people that work with her brother and that work with my son that are going to be working with a person with autism in a variety of capacities, as well-intended as some people may be, they don't always have training. They don't always know what to expect in a situation. So they're trying to figure things out, and they're thinking that, why is he doing this? And I was thinking as I was watching it, why don't you know? So I think that's one of the things that struck me, that and I see it in schools. I see it in the community. I see it when workers come to families. I just would reiterate how important it is before you start working with someone with a disability, and especially a person that's nonverbal who won't be able to explain certain things to you, that it's really important to do your homework and to not have it be about you, but to have it be about them.
Heather, you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. Some of the scenes she's probably talking about, I felt exactly the same way. And there actually was a day or two of focused training with the workers, with my family and myself. Somehow, I still felt like they were very unprepared. And I agree that it's really important to understand what it's like to have the autism this severe and what some of these behaviors mean. And I see a lack of that in a lot of our services.
And what's an example, if you don't mind, Heather, that you would either share that was in the film or wasn't, for our audience who might be wondering, when you say not prepared, what stands out to you?
Well, they couldn't understand Brian at all. And I think this is not really in the film as much as it was in the situation, but Brian, the way that he speaks, he mumbles a lot, and he'll say the word music as misket, and we know that as his family, and we were trying to impart this knowledge to the agency, but it just didn't get passed on as effectively as it could. So yeah, I was very worried when Brian transitioned, if I wasn't there, would they know what he was asking for?
Well, I mean, one of the things that happens is the social norm of language is what gets placed upon this person. So if this is what we do, if we communicate this way, if we say the word this way, if we greet this way, one of the things I noticed was at one point in the film, there's a worker who is working with Brian. She's helping him shower. She finishes the shower with him. He's getting ready, and she stands in his face, and she just continues to look at him, and she says, "What's your name? What's your name? What's your name?" And yeah, she must have said it about 15 times.
Right.
And it was really about her wanting him to say his name. And Brian's looking at her, and I'm wondering what's going through his head. I know what my name is, you know what my name is. What's this about? Why are you doing this to me? And let's say he wasn't even checked into her at all. It really was about her feeling like, I need you to say your name. I need you to talk. I need you to talk, because that mm-hmm. means something if you talk. And that was less about him. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. It made me uncomfortable.
Let me turn to Sarah Milko, Executive Director of Autism Up, for your thoughts on the film and what you'd want to share with Heather.
Sure. Heather, the thing that really stuck out to me was when you said you really got to know Brian after you followed him on film for, I think you said, 200 plus hours. And, mm-hmm. you know, if everybody had the time to spend with an individual with autism to really understand them. And like Melissa was saying, we put so much stock in verbal language, you know, and sometimes we're all too fast. We're moving way too fast in a way that we're just used to, that we don't stop and look at the body language. You know, I say all the time, my son is 18 and is very low verbal, has some language, but I think he's a terrific communicator. And I forget sometimes when he walks into a new place or he's dealing with new individuals, and they'll look at me and say, what's he saying? What's he doing? I'm like, how can you not understand him? Look at the way he's moving. You know, take the extra steps to understand and watch him, and you'll know exactly what he wants to convey. So I think that really stood out to me, that you took the time, and what a gift that must have been to you after all those years as a sibling, to be able to watch him through a different lens and say, oh my goodness, I get my brother. Mm. So that really stood out to me.
Yeah, that's powerful.
Heather, what's the relationship like now? How has it changed?
So now I feel like I'm able to better interact with him. Like, there are things that I've been able to do to bring new activities like into his life. I found some new music that he likes that relaxes him instead of just listening to Disney songs over and over again. And I think I think I understand Brian at this point now better than my parents. Like, I'm able to see him as an adult, whereas I think that they are stuck seeing him as a child that they need to take care of. And that's really the thing that changed for me, because it's really hard for a lot of people to understand someone like Brian as an adult, because people have this inclination to continue to show them kids movies, and Brian gets really frustrated when he's condescended to. So I think that's one of the main advantages that I got as our relationship changed through the film.
And Heather, if I could just add, I would venture to guess that your brother recognized that for the first time you were seeing him for who he is, you know? So yeah. I bet it's a two-way street there.
For sure. Yeah, I completely agree. His behavior towards me has changed a lot as well.
Melissa, you were nodding as well.
Yes, I was nodding because I remembered when my son was going from, you know, 10 years old to 12 to 14, I started to be very conscious of the fact that he was turning into a young man, and that mommy always being there, mommy taking him to the recreation programs, that I needed to begin to back off a little bit and allow him to establish other kinds of relationships that were important for his growing into some level of maturity.
I mean, it's the story of every parent, but it's probably especially acute when you have not only a child with autism, but a low or nonverbal child with autism.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my teaching him how to use a key to open the door. Yeah. I was horrified at the possibility of, oh my gosh, is he going to understand this? But it's an important milestone in his development. And while it wasn't something we could sit down and have a conversation about, I couldn't say, so how do you feel about this? And do you feel comfortable? And do you feel safe? It didn't mean I didn't do it. But I needed to, as Sarah was saying earlier, pay attention to his nonverbals, give him praise when he did it well. All of those things help to build confidence, not just what the person says, but what you can pour into them by way of expectations. Having higher expectations also builds confidence, and I think that's amazing.
In our second half hour, we'll talk more about the norm of verbalization and what families can do in navigating different kinds of communication. Let me turn it over to Dr. Salkis for his thoughts for Heather Cassano.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Heather, first of all, thank you for a very thought-provoking piece of work. And I'm amazed that you were able to whittle 200 hours down to one. But it's a phenomenal editing job and everything else. But so I also love the title of the piece. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not Brian's limits, it's the limits of the world around him. And I think that, you know, what we've been talking about so far really sort of points that up, that the people around him are limited in their ability to understand him. And you were, you know, until you got an opportunity to get closer with him. And I think that interaction between Brian and the world around him really comes through in the movie. And as my colleagues here were saying, that the effort on the part of the people around him to try to understand him was usually pretty clear. Okay, not every single person in his world is making the same effort. I have a question for you, though. I mean, you were talking about how he said the word music and people wouldn't understand that. And at one point in the film, I saw a communication device being messed mm-hmm. with. Okay, and I was thinking at that moment, okay, nobody around him communicates is understanding him. Is he using this device? Does it help him for the casual interaction? You know, people who get to know him well are going to learn to read him and understand him in ways that people who don't get to know him so well won't have the opportunity for. But was he using a communication device at all? And was it helpful for him?
So this is like one of my favorite things in the film, but one of the most frustrating things to me about Brian's life is that in the scene, you see him like press the button pizza over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. his psychologists and his workers, they think he doesn't know how to use it. But I actually think the opposite. I think he just wants pizza.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't saying something else. He was saying pizza, right? I mean, yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Like pizza and Doritos are his favorite foods, as all like young males know. Like these are indulgence foods. They won't let him eat that. And so I think that he doesn't think the communication device works because he's like, look, I'm pressing the thing, but I'm not getting any
right.
pizza. Right.
Exactly.
So I actually, you talk about his diet. I want to come back to that later in our discussion to talk about some of the health challenges that people like Brian encounter.
Okay. Yeah, I think
but we can save that for later.
Let's do that. And let me begin to wrap our half hour with Heather Cassano, the director of The Limits of My World, just by asking you if now you look at this film as, you know, I'm wondering as a director, what's a successful film here? Is it successful for you simply because you've taken the journey, you understand your brother better? Do you want to put it in front of more audiences like we're going to do on Monday at The Little? Are you hearing from people who are connecting with it?
Yeah, success is fluid with this film. I mean, there's different levels of it. I felt so proud when I finished it and when I screened it for the first time to audiences at IFF Boston. People have been amazing watching this film. The audiences have asked some incredible questions. It's like opened doors that I didn't think it would. But the main goal with the film now is to get it in front of more audiences. And we're trying to roll out kind of a university organization tour next fall, which can be booked on our website. So I'm thinking I want to use it for education and I want to use it to raise awareness and diversify representations of autism in the media.
Well, that's wonderful. Once again, we want to thank you for taking the time for us. And you can meet Heather Cassano via Skype. She's going to be joining the conversation after the screening of the film. It is, and I want to clarify something, this is important. It's Monday, 6 p.m. at The Little, and it's free. And so, contrary to what I said earlier this hour, let me amend something here. You don't have to buy tickets. You don't have to call The Little or go to thelittle.org. Please jump on wxxi.org for more information if you'd like it and if you want to share that. But it's first come, first serve. So please show up. Get there early, get your seat at The Little on Monday, 6 p.m., free, and a film worth watching for you and for anyone. Really, this is not just a film for families of children with autism. It's for all of us. Heather, congratulations again on making us think, making us feel and understand more. I know it's an important film. It's called The Limits of My World, and we will see you via Skype on Monday at The Little Theater. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to extend the conversation that Heather's film helped spark here. So much for us to understand about what norms of communication are and what it means for all of us as we navigate the world. Not only, again, not just because there may be children with autism in your family, but you are living in a world that is more inclusive. And we all want to go through this world in a more productive and caring and thoughtful way. So let's do that after this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, he's one of the outstanding classical guitarists in the world today. Iman Jarjour joins us, but not just to talk about his own music, He's on an American tour as part of a world tour to raise money for refugees. He's from Syria. He sees what's happening in his native Syria, and he sees the refugee crisis around the world. This extraordinary man is doing so much, and you will meet him next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you've been inspired by this conversation and you want to learn more about the challenges young people with autism and their families face, WXXI's Veronica Volk and Karen Chakurji produced a podcast on the subject called Exited. It follows the journey of several young people with disabilities as they transition from high school to adulthood. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts and also on WXXINews.org. The podcast and this broadcast is from WXXI's Inclusion Desk, a multi-platform reporting effort to inform and transform attitudes and behavior about inclusion, and it's made possible in part by the Golisano Foundation. So again, the podcast to look for is called Exited. All right, so the film that we're talking about in this hour is called The Limits of My World, showing for free, open to the public, on Monday night at 6 p.m. at the Little Theater. And you just heard from Heather Cassano, the director, and also the sister of Brian, who's featured in the film. And during our brief break, Sarah Milko from Autism Up, you were saying how important it was to you to hear directly from Heather mm-hmm. about this. Tell me why.
Well, when I first watched the movie, I was really excited when I first learned about it, because just in the title, I thought, oh, this is going to be a young adult who's like my son. And maybe they can tell the story that I'm always trying to convey about my son. And I watched it and I thought, ooh, no, that's not the story. This young man is not like my son. And I really, quite honestly, I've been wrestling with how, you know, the last 48 hours, how am I going to talk about this in a positive way? Because that film really had an impact on me. It showed an individual in a way of autism that is not familiar to me, but I know it's out there. But once I heard her talk, I got it. She and I are actually on the same page. She was trying to convey the message of an individual young man whose voice was not being heard. And the thing, again, that I really took away from that was it took her over 200 hours to really hear who he was. And so many times we're putting our loved ones with service providers who don't have the training and they don't have the understanding of what it's like to have autism. Hmm.
You want to add to that?
I learned a long time ago when my son was diagnosed, I said, you're still my son, and I'm going to see you. I'm going to see all of you. It isn't going to be autism. It's going to be, that's part of you,
right.
But it's not all that you are. And in my family, it was my son who has autism, and then I have another child, so a sibling, just, you know, the perspective that Heather was offering. And early on, I made sure that my younger son went into sibling groups and participated with other groups of other children who had brothers or sisters that had disabilities. Because I got it that I wanted him to see his brother. I wanted him to be able to fully understand how our lives might be a little different than others, but to assign value to it. So early on, when he was about 5 or 6 years old and his brother was 7, we were going to programs and we were with other families. And he was learning that autism wasn't this strange thing. It was a community. It may not have been everyone in his school, but there were other people out there that were experiencing what we experienced. And so as I was watching the film, I called my 16-year-old over and said, hey, I think you should be watching this, because I felt like he would have something to say. I felt that sibling perspective, he had his own nuances about it, his own life experiences with it, his own exposure, his own times when he stood up for his brother, when he saw his brother in a way other people didn't. So I thank Heather for putting her story out there. But just as Sarah said, it wasn't completely mine. And I remember as I was watching it, I was going, I was pricked at different things
yeah.
because of choices that I had made around how I wanted to see my son and how I wanted others to see him.
Right, right. Yeah. And just to add to that, Melissa, the thing that goes back in my head over and over again that you kind of started on was everybody's an individual.
Right.
And I think that was what Heather really wanted to focus on. My brother may have autism, but that doesn't define him. And a disability doesn't define anybody. It's really who they are inside. And when people take the time to get to know that individual,
absolutely,
you're gonna put that label aside. You got to see the person, you know?
And I remember a teacher telling me very early on, behavior is communication.
Exactly.
For a person who's nonverbal, it's not, if we assign it as violence, right? Mm-hmm. We say if this person hits or pushes, that they're being violent. That's a characterization. That's not an objective thing. That's a very subjective thing. We see what they're doing as violence. It may not be. It may be their way of saying, I said no.
Right.
I said I didn't want to do that, and you keep telling me to do it. I don't have the words to tell you no, so I'm just going to push your hand away and say no. And so it's important for us to be paying attention to the person when they're pushing your hand away and see that behavior as something that they're trying to tell us.
Okay, Dr. Right. Salkis?
Yeah, there were people who see the film, and I do recommend it, are going to see several situations in which Brian is being asked to participate in stuff because people think he's going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when he really gets into it, and there are times when he has no interest in it, and people just keep sort of like operating just right past him. You know, I'm not going to go into the details, but they just sort of like say, here, you're not doing this. Keep focusing on this. And he's turning away and doing self-stimulatory behaviors that they're saying, see, he's uncooperative. Mm. And it's not that he's uncooperative. He doesn't want to do it. You know, and he is communicating,
right,
just as you said.
Exactly.
But what's got to be so tough is that it really takes an investment of effort on people who want to enter his world to try to understand him, to try to read those cues that he's giving. And for people who interact with him less intensely or more casually, it's got to be very tough to interpret. I mean, and unless he's got someone with him interpreting his behavior for them. I mean, it's super tricky.
Right.
Well, and you're all talking about communication from a professional perspective. I mean, you're talking about it from a parental perspective, mm-hmm, but also from a professional perspective, mm-hmm, to at least, mm-hmm, some degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sarah points out that Heather Cassano, the director of the film and the sister of Brian in The Limits of My World, has said, you know, she spent 200 hours getting to know her brother.
Exactly.
You know, so it's one thing to say you're going to be a sibling, you're going to spend 200 hours. It's another to say I'm going to get training in a professional setting to be better at navigating a world if I'm working with children or adults with autism who are nonverbal. Now I want to ask you from the perspective, how about my perspective? Mm-hmm. There's no people with autism who are nonverbal in my family, but I want a more inclusive world. I want a world with more outreach, more love, more understanding. If I have friends, if I go over to the house of friends who have a child who is nonverbal, if I'm encountering in different public settings, mm-hmm, in essence, this is a little crude, I want a little etiquette lesson. I want to hear from what you mm-hmm want from all of us to help better understand and to show love and to also include.
Well, I think you've already taken the first step. You have an open mind. You're willing to not shy away from it. And I think that as parents,
yes,
that's our biggest challenge, is to say to this community, open your minds. And it's really on us as parents and siblings and professionals to keep reminding the community, and watch the cues of those of us who know, you know, just go with it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you spend 5 minutes and you watch the way loved ones interact with these individuals, you're going to get it. And I always like to say my son has a sixth sense because he doesn't have so much language. He knows when somebody gets him, mm-hmm, and he'll cue right into him. And if he knows he's making somebody uncomfortable, or they're looking at him as if he doesn't have the ability or the intellectual capacity to socialize, it's amazing what he will start to do to kind of play that up, right? He'll start to spin, he'll start to do all of his tricks, and then I'm like, come on. Kids know, young adults know, you know when you're connecting with somebody and when you're not, mm-hmm, you know?
So I think that one of the things the film shows us is that people who are pushing in and trying to invade his space a little bit, don't get so much success. Mm. The people who lay back and sort of say, I'm going to make myself interesting. I'm going to offer myself to you, and you can choose to engage or not, are likely to be more successful because it gives him the opportunity to feel in control of the situation a little bit.
Absolutely.
And so it's, like the over loving grandma who comes up and grabs the kid by the cheeks and says, "Oh, you're so cute," and the kid says, "Don't touch my face like that." It could be any kid. But for a person like Brian, who can't easily communicate that, he's going to pull back and be much more resistant. So just making yourself interesting is a way to help the person recognize that you're open to interaction.
Okay. And I think I would echo everything by giving an example of something that I'm going to be doing this evening. A pastor of a church and his wife asked me to come to the church to do a presentation on autism for their congregation. Mm-hmm. And they offered it to the church, and whoever wanted to sign up, they could. But the premise behind it was, we are a community, and we want to include everyone in our service. And anyone, we may very well have some people in the congregation who have autism, maybe not, but we want them to be able to come. And we want to create a community that is knowledgeable about it, that knows what to expect, that knows how to respond. Can you come and talk to us about it? So right away it came, it was this premise of, we want to learn. There's more we want to do to help us understand, so that we don't put our labels or our judgments on. We want to understand them. I think that's amazing.
And it
more
demystifies it.
You
people will maybe looking at, okay, what's going on here? But as soon as you put it out there and you give a quick explanation, everybody just goes, oh, okay, I get it.
The church that I attend, I've had some members, and I've been there maybe about 5 months or so. So we're relatively new. My son and I both attend. And I noticed some people, congregants, coming to me and saying, do you think maybe the music is a little too loud for him? Because they're paying attention and noticing that he's putting his hands up to his ears, or at certain points he's standing up, and they notice it when the choir is singing. That alone is that they are paying attention to what he's trying to share with them, but then also saying, what can we do to make him more comfortable? That was amazing.
That's outstanding.
That when it wasn't just, he's annoyed, maybe he should leave. It was, we want to make him comfortable. Should we get some earphones? Should we sit this place? Should we lower the music? It brought tears to my eyes. It let me know that this was the right place.
Well, let me also ask all of you how we can continue to improve our engagement without infantilizing. Because I think so often when we are met with what is outside what we consider the norm of communication, we assume that there is something that requires a kind of a child's touch or some kind of... And. I wonder, first of all, for those of us even with good intentions, when we do that, can that actually make a situation worse? Can that hurt?
Ooh, absolutely.
Yes. Sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Sure. Absolutely. Someone having a nonverbal ability or someone having an intellectual disability or any type of disability, whether it's physical or otherwise, doesn't mean that they are not a human being, a person who has feelings, has thoughts. And so I would say engagement with them at the same level that you would someone else, not necessarily having a full-fledged conversation if that person isn't comfortable doing that, but not in a condescending way, not in a way as if you're talking to a child, because this isn't a child.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's an adult person.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, you want to add to that?
I was just going to say, and to always remember, just because you're nonverbal doesn't mean you're hard of hearing. I mean, the number of people who speak to my son really loud and slow, and he just looks at me. And I'm like, well, I find that even through Autism Up, because we interact with so many young adults and so many families, it's the kids that respond immediately and will make eye contact with you. If you talk to them same way you would anybody else. Mm-hmm. And they look at you and they think, oh, that person gets me.
Dr. Yeah. Salkis?
I was just going to say, talking about this in multiple different settings, but one setting that I always come back to is the healthcare setting. And thinking about what it means to be nonverbal and go to the physician or go to the dentist and have somebody trying to ask you what's bothering you, mm-hmm. and you can't easily communicate it. And then when they try to go touch you, they just attack you, and, you know, in a way that is very upsetting. It requires a lot of extra time. It requires patience on the part of the healthcare provider. It requires a sensory-friendly and motor-friendly environment. Mm-hmm. And people asking, how does this person communicate? And one of the other difficulties for a guy like Brian is that now when he has to go to the doctor, it's probably going to be staff who take mm-hmm. him. And they are not so easily able to describe what's going on for him. If his family goes, they're not actually in the house where he's living watching him to understand what's going on. So they may right. be good at picking up his cues, but not know exactly what's happening. You can see how healthcare can get to be really fragmented for a person like Brian, because you end up going in and people just do stuff to the patient mm-hmm. And it ends up being invasive and uncomfortable. Yeah.
I think the other thing I would echo in related to that is relationships.
Yeah.
I noticed in the film that when Brian was transitioning from the school he was attending to now living independently, there was an aide or a worker who worked with him at the school. And I was watching her. She had a relationship with him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was emotional when she was leaving. She said, I'm going to try not to cry. It isn't just a handoff. Okay, bye. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I'm going to hand him off to someone else. And now this had been years. She had been with him. And she understood him and she knew him and she was going to miss him. And I think that's important that as we're having transitions and as we're going to medical appointments and recognizing that there are people in their lives that matter. I've done that with my son, that when we've left a school or when couple of years ago, we moved away, I recognized that there were people that he was connected to and that people that cared about him. And we said goodbye and we went over and we, you know, those things matter. Just because the person doesn't talk doesn't mean they don't connect.
They're not thinking about it. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. Of course.
Well, before the hour's up, I know Dr. Salkis, there was something in the film that you keyed in on and you want to talk a little bit more on, and that's diet. Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so for those who did not hear the earlier part of the discussion, there was a point where Brian, the hero of the film, is using a touch-talking device, and the button he keeps pushing is pizza, pizza, pizza. And they say, no, you can't have pizza now. And they think he's not actually effectively communicating. Later on in the film, he just goes to the fridge and grabs a sandwich, and the staff person says, no, you can't. That's your lunch for tomorrow. You can't eat that. So she gives him a bag of chips. And I'm thinking, you know, and he eats the chips, you know, but I'm thinking, this is not such a healthy diet. Yeah. And yet he does not look like he's obese or, you know, out of shape. And I'm thinking this is watching him stay healthy is a secondary challenge. Getting him through his day is everybody's primary challenge. Being healthy is sort of like way down the list. The other thing was that at least one moment early in the film, I saw a big thing of pills that he was taking. And I was wondering what they were for, what side effects they were causing for him, and whether people were actually thinking about that as a hunk of his life. But wellness activities for people like Brian are tricky because they have to incorporate the stuff he likes. And that right. takes, it comes right back to communication and how people learn what a person's interests are.
Right.
Communication and yeah. education. Mm-hmm. When you mentioned the medicine, in my role as a family navigator, one of the things that I do is talk to the parents about how important it is for them to understand medicine, understand what its side effects are. What are these different medicines addressing? What behaviors are they addressing? And within the autism community, the Autism Treatment Network has been able to develop toolkits and information that's now available to break some of that down. Yeah. Because for us, it's all about educating the people who are going to be working with the practitioner, with the doctors, so that they can have a joint conversation.
That medication decision aid is at autismspeaks.org.
Yes, it is.
For people who want to download it.
It's an excellent tool. You talk about medication and education and those social and recreational opportunities that are so important.
And we
talk about this all the time. You know, our kids with autism, where my typical children, I'm the mother of three, were doing after school sports. Yeah. You know, I mean, when you're growing, the young kids, especially through the teenage years, they have so much energy.
Yes.
It needs to be an outlet. And our kids with autism don't have those opportunities. So that's something, you know, as a parent-driven organization, we have been so focused on making sure your kids get exercise regardless of their disability.
As we get ready to wrap the hour, can I ask all of you for your perspective on sort of the next frontier of inclusion in that when you look at the history of our country, we had many dark years of institutionalization, and that's not to say that you know we're in a sort of a utopia for inclusion. Certainly, we've made many, many strides. What does it look like in a generation from now if everything is what you want it to be, Sarah?
I'm always a glasses half full. I think we are on the cusp of something really big. I think for the first time ever, really, we're looking at individuals with disabilities in a whole new way. I think the frontier is bright for these individuals as long as we keep pushing and we keep, you know, yelling it from the rooftops. People got to pay attention. They need to be included in our community. I feel like our community needs to be trained and be prepared. But there's vocational opportunities. There's residential opportunities, educational opportunities. But it's really it's a shift in our community's mindset. And I think it's going to happen here in Rochester.
I think it's a shift away from separate facilities, people going off to a different place, but a shift towards everyone is part of what accommodations do we make to meet the needs of everyone here in this place. I think that's the direction we're going. And I think people are, as folks are getting older, people with disabilities are getting older, they're living with family members, that we're thinking about things like extending homes and having nearby homes so that they can be with their family. So I think we're thinking about things differently, not institutionalization, but more inclusion within the community. I think that's the direction we're moving in, and I'm excited about it for my son.
Dr. Self? Yeah,
absolutely. I think that we're in a position where, you know, I absolutely don't want specialized stuff to be the only thing we have, you know, because then it's non-inclusive. On the other hand, some of the specialized things that we have, programs like those run by Autism Up and stuff that we do at University of Rochester, helps others to learn how to be inclusive. My goal was for every primary care physician to be completely comfortable incorporating every patient who has a developmental disability of any kind into his or her practice. That's a challenge because people say, no, we've got to go to a specialist. So if we can get everybody doing it, it's great. So
forgive me for asking you to estimate, but I am curious because if the goal is to have every primary care physician able to incorporate into their own practice people, kids, adults with developmental disabilities, what's the percentage right now that you think are doing that?
I'm going to say 5.
5%.
Well, it depends on the level of disability.
Okay.
And it also depends on the age focus of the primary care provider. Mm. Kids, developmental disabilities emerge in childhood, so people who do pediatric or family medicine, people who focus on children, will have those kids in their practice. For guys like Brian who are moving into the adult world, it's a tiny percentage. Mm-hmm. And then it's well-intentioned healthcare providers who are willing to stretch a bit and maybe go try to learn some skills and adapt their practices, but they usually do not have very many people in their practices, and then the word gets out and they start getting
more. We all start flocking.
Right, exactly.
So but overall, probably 5% of people are really are if we're lucky, 5% are comfortable.
But what I think is so unique about this community is, as you have, we have, you know, those of you at the Levine Autism Center, you have these parent-led organizations like Autism Up. We have Tom Galassano, who understands our needs and is so generous. I mean, you put those things together.
This is an area that is proactive, is progressive, is forward-thinking. If change is going to happen, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen here. Yeah,
It is.
I always appreciate the optimism from all three of our panelists here. And it's been a wonderful discussion this hour. Our thanks to Sarah Milko from Autism Up. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Dr. Salkis, who is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at URMC. Great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
And our thanks to Melissa Parrish from the Galassano Autism Center as a family navigator and at the Boys and Girls Club of Rochester. And parents as well in the room. So thank you for your perspective. And Monday night, the Little Theater is showing the film The Limits of My World, 6 p.m. It's free, first come, first serve, and a talk back, a conversation with the director following that film. Short break, more connections coming up.